Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 343. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com with whatever's on your mind. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have not one, but two incredible guests for you on this week's show. Let's get started by introducing the first one. Jake Graff is a writer, a director, an actor, a producer, and so much more. His first film, XY, that's W-H-Y, which he wrote, directed, produced, and starred in, was nominated for the Iris Prize. Brace, another one of his projects, was screened at 33 film festivals worldwide. It was nominated also for an Iris Prize. It won Best Shorts at Germany's Queer Streifen Festival, and it won the Kinsey Award for Diversity at the Bloomington Pride Film Festival right here in Indiana. Jake's film, Change, was one of five films selected to take part in the pioneering project #5FilmsForFreedom, which was in association with the BFI and the British Council to promote tolerance and understanding worldwide. We love that. Jake was seen on screens everywhere all over the world in The Danish Girl, the Oscar-nominated film, which I adored. It has its digital HD release date of February 16th and a Blu-ray, DVD, and on-demand release date of March 1st. He has other projects coming out, which we will discuss, but for right now, from all the way across the pond, he is here with us. Jake, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, Ken. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
So much to talk about, Jake. Are you ready?
I am ready. Hit me with it.
All right. Well, first, let's start with the medium of film. Why the medium of film to get your voice out there, Jake?
I have always found myself getting lost in movies and film. When I was a kid, I spent a lot of time just sort of in my head, and, you know, I kind of lived vicariously through the characters that I'd see on film, you know, all the kind of early James Bond films and, you know, all the superhero films and so on. So for me, it's always been film. I've always dreamed of being an actor and of telling stories and making films. So it sort of seemed an obvious choice. You know, I like things that move and then keep my attention. So it's good for me.
Nice. I said in your bio, a writer, a director, an actor, a producer. Is there one label to which you particularly gravitate?
I mean, acting is my joy. It's not the thing that I've sort of got the most experience with. Writing is actually the thing that I find the easiest. But as it turns out, I've directed now 3 shorts, and it sort of seems I've got a bit of a flair for that. And I'm kind of, the more I do, the more I enjoy directing, strangely enough. The one label I would sort of veer away from is producer, because I hate producing, although obviously, you know, I have had to do it because sometimes you got to do it.
Yeah, I don't like asking for the money, Jake. It's not my thing.
No, it's really not. I hate it. I'd rather sort of sell myself. So I was going to say sell myself. I obviously wouldn't rather sell myself, but I'd rather do anything but ask someone else for money.
Would you say that there is one narrative thread that connects all of your different projects?
All of my films, strange enough, tend to be two-player pieces, two sort of the main two players. And they, I guess they're all sort of drama/romances. XY had two characters that sort of were in love and fell out of love. Brace, again, was the same. It was two characters that met and struggled with who they were and whether or not they could be together. Chance, again, two sort of older men who fell in love. And my newest, Short Dawn, which, again, is two people who sort of meet and just have a connection and change each other's lives just out of a sort of 10-minute connection. And so I guess that will be the thread, just sort of, you know, human connections and how we can change each other's experiences and you know, just change sort of a few minutes in someone's day and make a real impact.
Nice. Dawn, Brace, Chance, XY. Do you, Jake Graff, have an aversion to a two-word title?
I do. How could you tell? I think it's a good thing to just, you know, go to sort of put it out there. Just a short, punchy one word. The next one actually does that I'm looking at is called Dusk. So just to sort of keep with the thread.
It would be too much. You want it just written in big letters on the marquee. We don't want more than one word.
Well, obviously, I mean, The Danish Girl totally threw me. So, you know, I just wanted to call it Danish.
I knew it. If people think it's a dessert flick, but no, you just had to shorten it to just one word. Yes, it's perfect. I just saw all of the Oscar-nominated shorts the other day at our local theater, and that has to be just a much different challenge in getting that story out there in a shorter amount of time.
It is a challenge, particularly because when I start writing, I end up just writing, and it's always, when I look at, you know, a film like The Danish Girl, which I think is 2 hours long, or, you know, I was told that the original cut was about 3.5 hours, and then they sort of said, no, Tom, and kind of cut it down to, I think it's two. You know, for me, I really try and get, everyone keeps saying to me, you know, the perfect short is between 8 and 12 minutes, so I really go for that, but I find that I usually end up with about 20 minutes, and then we kind of have to cut that down. So, you know, the luxury of having 2 hours to play with, I can't even imagine, it must be amazing.
Yeah. I was reading about XY, and I was reading about how you used your own transition to tell the story of the fictional trans man in the film. What did you learn about yourself in making a film where you used yourself as inspiration?
The whole thing for XY was, you know, I'd always wanted to act, and pre-transition there was no way I would have been able to put myself out there on screen happily, because, I mean, even looking in the mirror was a bit of a struggle. So I wanted to do it, but knew that it was nothing I was going to ever be able to do, you know, until I was happy within myself. So I kind of geared up for making a film, and I had this idea in my head. And once I decided to bite the bullet and go ahead and begin testosterone and so on, I just wrote this screenplay. It was, you know, it actually was quite short and to the point, strange enough, for the first time. And the whole experience was incredibly cathartic. It was very reflective of what was going on in my life. I had a girlfriend who identified as a lesbian, and obviously when I started going through all the changes and sprouting facial hair and so on, she understandably kind of, you know, balked at that, because that's not what lesbians like, and well, generally, and she sort of kind of left me. So all the experiences of the character in XY, that's obviously all the physical changes that I was going through at the time. You know, we shot it over 2 years, and at the beginning I look like a sort of, you know, young boy, and by the end of it I look like a man. And so, you know, it was incredibly cathartic, incredibly helpful, and I learned a huge amount. It was kind of a bit of a baptism of fire, but, you know, it's a film that I'll always have as a sort of, you know, record of my transition, which I guess is great, and you know, something very special to sort of show the grandkids.
Yeah, oh, amazing work. Well, let's talk about The Danish Girl. We'll give it its full title. How did you come to be involved with this film?
God only knows. I think I'd obviously put myself out there. I was one of the leads in Brace, which I wrote about 4 years ago. And Brace has done the rounds. When you said 33 film festivals, Brace has actually been to 55 film festivals now.
Nice.
And it did the rounds of the circuit for about 2 years, and it's still getting picked up now. So because people have seen it, and obviously there weren't, and there still aren't many trans actors out there, and I know the producers of The Danish Girl were adamant that they would cast as many trans actors in various roles as possible. You know, I think they used quite a lot of trans actors in Belgium in sort of supporting roles and so on. And the casting agency over in London, Nina Gold, looked and in fact auditioned many, many trans people and trans actors over here, because, as I say, they really did want to give as much opportunity to trans actors as possible. But again, you know, there aren't a lot of trained trans actors.
So I
you know, they did what they could, and luckily I was one of the people that went along and auditioned, and I read for three parts and ended up getting one. And I mean, it may be a small part, but you know, it was a dream come true. Getting the phone call to say that I had a part on The Danish Girl was just phenomenal. So that was how it happened.
And you had your own trailer, I read.
There was a plethora of trailers everywhere, but I was sort of putting my own trailer. You know, they flew me over to Belgium, and, you know, beautiful hotel, beautiful streets, beautiful locations. You know, we all had our own trailers, these amazing, huge trailers that obviously I'd never seen the like of. I'd been fitted with one of Eddie Redmayne's hair pieces because it was slightly too dark for him. So they put that on me, and they did actually really want me to shave my beard. And I said, well, I was actually shooting a web series the following week, and I said, I really, for continuity, cannot shave my beard. And I didn't know that in the 1920s, 1930s, nobody had facial hair. So this was a big, you know, can we still use him? And luckily the hair and makeup team decided that they could, in fact, allowed me to go on with my beard and Eddie Redmayne's hairpiece. And so, you know, I was on set in my 1920 suit, suited and booted in my trainer and ready to go. It was a dream come true.
There was some criticism when the casting all came down of Eddie Redmayne in that part. And you said this in one interview. You said, quote, "I understand the criticism, but it's not by any means something that I agree with. We bemoaned our lack of visibility for decades. And like it or not, the visibility for this film could not be any higher." What has it been like for you getting feedback about the film? Because it has been critically acclaimed all across the world.
Absolutely, because it's an amazing film. I mean, I don't agree with it. There are so many different reasons why I don't agree with any of the criticism of the casting. You know, there are very few actors, full stop, be they cisgendered or be they transgendered, who could command a budget of £40 million, who could play a role so beautifully. You know, I understand that fair enough there are people who would say that a trans woman would have played the role possibly better, but you know, show me a high-level trans woman who's gone through the amount of, you know, who has the amount of experience as Eddie, who has the finesse as Eddie, who has the subtleties and nuances of Eddie, and in that case, by all means, put them out there. But you know, I certainly haven't seen them thus far. You know, also the reach that someone like Eddie Redmayne has is incomparable, and I think, you know, I quite honestly have had friends, because I lived in New York about 10 years ago, friends who, as trans people, said, you know, it's kind of from Midwest America, that they have had contact from their parents for the first time in 5 or even 10 years, because their parents sort of tentatively went out and saw this film that had all this publicity and so on, and saw The Danish Girl and had their, I guess, their sort of eyes open somewhat, because it was such a sensitively, beautifully and authentically told story. And they've actually contacted their children after sort of 5 or 10 years and kind of reached out olive branches of peace. And again, I don't think that that could have happened were it not for someone as high level as Eddie Redmayne and Tom Hooper having kind of, you know, taken this story in hand. So, you know, I think when in 10 years or so there are enough trans actors to give a, you know, to really be able to audition a huge range of people, then great. But I certainly would never knock the choice of casting, because I think it was, you know, he's stunning in the role. How could you possibly knock that?
Yeah. Yeah, it was an incredible film. An incredible film.
I've cried. I've seen it twice with my mother both times, and I've cried both times, and my mother's cried both times, and all of my friends have cried, and I think it's stunning. I just have nothing to say against it. I'm going to see it again on Friday.
Yeah. What can we all do to support more trans actors being in films, to support more trans content getting out there in the world?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously Focus Features is running this great project in the States at the moment, where they are kind of heralding or pushing, promoting a trans filmmaker with a $10,000 grant, which is great. And obviously, you know, Focus Features, of which I'm a huge fan, who've been responsible for pushing the film out in the States. Unfortunately, we don't have anything like that over here in the UK yet. I mean, it's a tough one, because a lot of trans people, they are more sort of concerned with saving for their surgeries than going off to the local drama class on a
right.
Saturday morning, or, you know, trying to kind of, you know, keep afloat, or trying not to, you know, I mean, there's so much, I guess, that you know, these people, and, you know, often quite young people, have got to deal with, that, you know, their first thought isn't sort of, you know, let's go off and do a drama course or do an acting course. So, you know, it is tough, but I think more people need to sort of put themselves out there. You know, I went to quite recently a trans acting course that was run at Central School of Speech and Drama, which is a prestigious drama school in London. And they actually ran an acting course specifically for trans people. So there was about 20 of us. And Eddie Redmayne, strange enough, actually popped along for an hour and spoke to us all there and about his methods and so on. And so, I mean, it was a great experience. And that was over 5 weeks. And they're actually pushing for that to happen again. And I've had so many people contacting me and saying, you know, how did this happen? Who organized this? You know, would it be possible to bring this to my hometown? And this was from all across the world. So I think, you know, little steps like that. But I think it's just, you know, it's very hard for any sort of smaller group, particularly with trans people. There are so few of us out there anyway, that really, you know, with any kind of audition, particularly for big roles, the number of people that get auditioned is huge. And when
right.
there are so few of us anyway, it is tough to find the right person for the role when you've already got such a tiny pool of people. So, you know, it's a difficult situation.
Yeah. Again, listeners, we are here with writer, director, actor, somewhat reluctant producer, Jake Graff. Jake, I have put together some Jake Graff ephemera that I have pulled together from the web. Can I hit you with some random topics?
Yes, please do. This makes me incredibly nervous. Go for it.
Only one of them should make you nervous, and I'll save that for the last one. Let's start with the organization All About Trans that I've read all about. Tell our listeners about All About Trans.
All About Trans is a great project that was started, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. I think it's London-based. I volunteer for them as well. They have lots of volunteers all over the UK. And there was, I think it was sort of started because about 4 or 5 years ago, a woman called Dr. Kate Stone was gored by a stag going into her garden late at night. It's an unfortunate story, and I shouldn't laugh. But the reason that this all came about is because she was gored by the stag, and instead of reporting that it was a woman who was gored by a stag, and in fact, I think nearly died, it was a trans woman, transgender woman, sex change woman, and so on. And there was this huge sort of uproar within the trans community that she hadn't just been reported as a poor woman who'd been gored. And so All About Trans sort of came about because they have started going around media outlets all around the UK, and they've done everyone from The Guardian to The Telegraph to The New Statesman to The Daily Mail. So, you know, they've done kind of across the political spectrum, and they go and sit and interact with media editors and writers and so on and so forth to try and, I think, broaden people's sort of perspectives of trans people and the trans experience, and, you know, just get people sort of au fait with terms like cisgender and non-binary and genderqueer and so on. So, you know, they're doing a great job, and at the same time, they're a presence and they're a body that trans people kind of across the UK can look to if they need guidance or help or anything. So All About Trans does excellent work.
There you go. An amazing organization. You can read up on them, allabouttrans.org.uk. Topic number two, again, this isn't one that should make you nervous. It's the third topic. Topic number two, you were the first trans man to appear on the cover of the magazine QX, and one could argue, Jake, you were not wearing a three-piece suit on that cover.
One could argue that. Actually, all of this, I have to give a credit to FTM magazine, because it was FTM magazine, which is in fact New York-based, and which is female-to-male magazine, and is the first, it's the sort of biggest magazine for trans men, and they launched me last spring or summer, and they put me on the cover. It was my first ever magazine cover, and since then, it has just taken off, and I was on the cover of San Diego LGBT Weekly, and then QX, and GNI, and various other, anyway, I've done 6 covers, which has been phenomenal, and in a few of them, yes, people have requested that I have no top on, so it sort of seems to be the thing that, you know, there are these trans guys kind of popping out, you know, people like Aidan Dowling and so on, who did the, you know, the Adam Levine photo,
yes,
where he was, in fact, totally lacking in clothes. I prefer to keep my jeans on. And it's been for trans male visibility across the board. You know, I see all these young guys coming up and doing great things and making films and you know, popping up on the covers of Men's Health magazine and so on. So, you know, it's been a real honor to be a part of that, top on or off.
Oh, fantastic visibility there. And topic number three, and I don't want to out you on this, but I'm going to. I'm just saying there's a little bit of reluctance here. I did read online that you do have a particular fondness for the movie Titanic. Is that correct?
I got it. Is that as bad as it's going to get?
It's not too bad. I'm very nice to my guests here, Jake. We've been doing this show for a long time. We want you to come back.
You will not. I have absolutely no embarrassment whatsoever. I'm a huge fan of James Cameron, from Terminator to Titanic to Avatar. I think they're great. And, you know, Titanic is the love story that we all want. I mean, obviously without the dying and the sinking ship and so on. You know, it's the kind of love story and the Jack and the Rose and the, you know, it's something that I think we all aspire to. So, yes, definitely.
All right. I'm just checking. She says, "I'll never let you go," and then she lets him go within 30 seconds of that. I'm just saying that's how the movie ends,
well,
Jake.
It's more the point that she's clearly got enough room on this huge piece of wood for Jack. I mean, you know, she was a little larger than she is now, but by the same token, he was a skinny chap, and she could have just, you know, let him share a little bit of it, but that's... Again, I think a story plot line, and it had to happen. Jack had to go.
If you're choosing between Jack and the necklace, we choose the necklace. That's the way it works.
Well, absolutely. And then, you know, you had to sort of see her in her dream riding along on the horse at the end. And had Jack lived, that might not have happened. So it's all very important.
There it is. All right, well, tell everybody about the project Dawn. That looks like that's what's coming up next for you. Is that correct?
Dawn is coming up next. So Dawn is a... it's my most recent short, which I'm very proud of. We were very lucky. It was all shot at dawn over three mornings, three night shoots from 2:30 in the morning till midday over three nights. One was a weekend night, so we had lots of drunken revelers barging into set and sort of disturbing things. But it was filmed just on the outskirts of London and on a cold October, it's like no, September morning. We have a trans female lead, a newcomer, a woman called Nicole Gibson, who's absolutely stunning in the role, and a young guy called Harry Rundle in playing opposite her, who was in fact the lead opposite in The Embrace. And, you know, he was amazing in Embrace, and we thought it would be remiss not to give him another go. And so he is the lead in Dawn, and it's the score by a woman called Justine Barker, who also did the score for Chance, is phenomenal. The whole thing, I mean, I've got this great team now that I've worked with on Chance and now Dawn as well. And I mean, I'm so excited about this one going out there. And I was told recently, I don't know whether this is true or not, but by a couple of trans women told me that trans women tend not to make so many movies, that it's more the boys that are making films and so on. So I thought it would be nice to write a story for the ladies. So yeah, that's what's happening. We've got a couple of premieres lined up. Well, we've got a UK and US premiere, neither of which I can talk about until next week, unfortunately. But we're very, very excited about Dawn. So I really hope that it does the same as Brace and Chance and sort of, you know, storms the queer festival circuit.
Nice. Love it. Love it. Well, finally, for all of our up-and-coming filmmakers out there, as someone who has a production company called Up and Up Productions, what is Jake Graff's patented advice for our up-and-coming filmmakers who want to get their voice out there?
I would say just do it. And I know everybody says this, and I know obviously, you know, it's a lot to do with financial constraints and restraints and a lot to do with just finding the time and so on and so forth. But if you're desperate to make a film and you've got a story to tell, realistically, it's all about the story. You can have something that's stunning, and if there's no sort of content, if there's nothing real happening there, then people aren't interested. You can honestly, if you look at a film like, oh my God, I was about to call it Satsuma, but it's not Satsuma, it's Tangerine, isn't it?
Yes, Tangerine, sure.
Tangerine. Yes, exactly, not Satsuma, Tangerine, and that was filmed entirely on iPhones and which has done phenomenally well. So my advice would be, if you've got something you'd like to say, if you've got a message, if you've got a voice, then just be brave, go out there, you know, do it on your weekends, do it on your evenings. Don't be that person who, you know, at sort of 60 years old is sitting there saying, I wish I'd done that film, I had such a great idea, and, you know, if only, because, you know, there's no point in this life in having regrets. Life is too short. So my advice would be, in anything in life, if it's something that you want badly enough, then just go out and do it, because at least then, you know, you don't sit there sort of wishing that you had.
There it is. Where can all of our listeners go to follow all the cool things that you're doing?
Well, I'm quite proud of my Instagram account at the moment, so find me on Instagram. I think I'm Jake_Graff5. And obviously I'm on Facebook, and obviously Brace, if you Google Brace, you'll see Brace, which is actually online on Vimeo, and that's a free watch if anyone wants to look at Brace short film. And Chance is going to be online probably early summer. Dawn will be storming the festival circuit, fingers crossed, near you sometime soon as well. And so it goes on. So, you know, I'm certainly there if you care to look.
Oh, we are all caring to look, and everybody's going to look you up. Jake Graff can be seen in The Danish Girl, the Oscar-nominated film, which again has its digital HD release date February 16th and Blu-ray, DVD, and on-demand release date of March 1st. Jake, you are putting out amazing content. You have an authenticity to everything that you're putting out there for us to consume, and you represent a voice that needs to be heard, and that's what we're all about here. We urge you to keep doing what you're doing. It's really quite incredible to behold.
Thank you so much, Ken. It's been a huge pleasure to talk to you tonight. Thank you so much for having me.
When they make the movie of my life, I hope they get somebody beautiful to play me. Somebody eloquent and beautiful to play me. When they make the movie of my life. And when they make the movie movie of my life. I hope they get somebody famous to direct it. Somebody famous and a genius to direct it when they make the movie of my life. And everyone will see how hard it's been for me, how much I've overcome to be someone deserving of a motion picture. And when they write the book about my life, I hope
All right, folks, and we are back with our second amazing guest for this week's episode. Let me introduce her. Liz Margulies is the founder and executive director of the National LGBT Cancer Network, the first national program addressing the needs of all LGBT people with cancer and those at risk. In addition to this work, you know, in all of her spare time, Liz is a psychotherapist with a private practice in New York City specializing in trauma, loss, health disparities, and sexuality. And right this second, she's here with us. Liz, welcome to this show with So Gay.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So much to chat about, Liz. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right.
I'm a New Yorker. I'm a big talker.
You are a New Yorker. You grew up in Westchester. I was reading all about you.
I didn't know that was even public knowledge, but yes.
I grew up in Bergen County, New Jersey. We were neighbors. Of course I highlight that. It's very
important.
And
I moved to New York City the second I was able to, and it's remained my most enduring romantic love.
I love that. Oh, look at that. That made me feel better about life just hearing that. Now, growing up there in the Westchester area or throughout your education, was there always a focus for you on, look, I just want to be working with people?
You know, I remember my parents pulled up for some reason to something like what we'd call today a strip mall. And I was sitting in the car while one of them ran in to get something. And I couldn't have been more than like 6 or 8. And I watched a man walk by on the sidewalk. And the way I framed the question in my mind was, if I could be a little bird in his brain, I wonder what I'd see him thinking.
Wow.
And I wanted to be a psychotherapist from that moment forward. I didn't know there was a job. I didn't know you didn't have to be a bird in someone's brain. But it has been, it's a calling. It's not a job.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no doubt what all of the many, many people you've worked with would say about the benefits in working with you. But what do you get out of being a psychotherapist? What does it do for you?
Lots of things.
Yeah.
First of all, I think the difference between a life that feels good and one that doesn't is simply feeling connected.
Yeah.
And I form a profound, intimate relationship with every one of my clients so that I don't spend my day making widgets.
Right.
I don't spend my day, you know, driving. I spend my day connecting with humans on the most raw human level. I see plenty of pain, but that's part of the human experience, and I feel honored to be let in on it.
Yeah. Let me just touch on this quickly. You know, in my many years in working in colleges and universities, certainly dealing with the stigma around people seeing a therapist, students seeing a therapist and overcoming those obstacles. What is one way that we can all grease the wheels to have people get the support that they might need?
Let me go back before even answering that question to say many of the people that I see would make it through their lives fine without me.
Yeah.
It's not the difference between life and suicide or life, a decent life and total poverty or a loveless life. But I think we all deserve all the help we can get. It's a tough world.
Yeah.
And there are big questions that people ask themselves, especially around college and the mid to late 20s, which is like, where is the place for me on this planet? How
right.
much does money matter? What is the role of love and work? What kind of relationship do I want to maintain with my family of origin? And do most people bumble through this without any help? Yes, but not everybody can.
Right.
And not anybody has to.
There it is. There it is. All right. Well, in 2007, something triggered you deciding, I would suspect it happened before then, coming up with this idea of we need a national LGBT cancer network. Trace us back through the route of how this came to be created.
You want the real answer,
or
you want something public that might sound good?
No. I want the real answer.
The real answer is I was in a long-term relationship that was just one of those high-maintenance relationships. If we didn't spend a lot of time together, there was just a problem.
Yeah.
And the relationship was kind of clearly going south after 10 years. And I said, oh, I think I need a little job in addition to my private practice. I think I want to be more busy because I don't need to be given this much time to this relationship. And I always had a strong attachment to the New York City LGBT Community Center.
Yes.
And I went to my colleagues there and said, I need a little job. Need me to do anything? I need to fill more time. And they said, well, we just got a grant from the Komen Foundation to start a lesbian cancer program. I said, I don't know anything about cancer except that I've had three friends die of ovarian cancer, but, and what are the odds of that?
Right.
But I don't know anything about it. They said, you'll learn. And I'm a social worker by education, and social workers love a new problem. Like, it was fascinating to me. So it was a part-time job. I didn't know what a grant was. I didn't know what a deliverable was. I was just a psychotherapist in private practice fulfilling my life's dream. But I found it compelling. And the more I learned about the health disparities that lesbian and bisexual women faced, the more interested I became.
Yeah.
And then it became clear to me that these similar, if not identical, health disparities, and I will go into them if you want, were not limited to lesbians and bisexual women, but were shared by all subpopulations of the LGBT community. And I told them that knowing what I now know a year after doing this, I don't think this is the right program. I think we need something else. I think the way to make a difference is not just to offer support to those who've been diagnosed with cancer, but to change the healthcare experiences, to see what we can do to lower the cancer risks of our community. And I want to do all this. And they said, well, we can't really have you do it here. I said, fine. I took my dog. I sat in the aisle of Barnes & Noble on how to start a nonprofit. And in my 50s, I started a nonprofit.
Nice. Oh, I love it. Well, you all approach this work in three different ways, and I want to hit all, I'm sure more than three, but three that we're going to call out, and I would love to hit all of these different areas. We start out with educating the LGBT community about our increased cancer risks and the importance of screening and early detection. How do we approach that?
Well, the increased risks we have, I want to emphasize, are not because our bodies are different, but because the stress and stigma of living as sexual and gender minorities has led to many behaviors that increase cancer risks. For example, smoking rates are 68% higher in LGBT people, and among trans people, the highest ever.
Wow.
Same with alcohol. Lesbians are more likely to be overweight or have a high-fat diet, and gay bisexual men or men who have sex with men are more likely to have anal HPV, which can lead to anal cancer. Taken all together, our risks are higher.
Yeah.
And yet, as a group, we've avoided the healthcare system, partly because our insurance rates were lower and partly because of previous negative experiences or feared discrimination. So I didn't want to just treat cancer survivors. I wanted to begin to do something far more radical and get the message out to our people, which is we have to live. We weren't meant to survive, as Audre Lorde said, but let's commit the radical act of living and being healthy.
Nice. Nice. Prong number two of this work, training healthcare providers to offer more culturally competent, safe, and welcoming care. And my gosh, I suspect, Liz, you and I could unpack that for many, many days, particularly the phrase culturally competent, which I know is very much on your mind these days. How do we start with the training of healthcare providers?
Well, first, let me connect it to the first piece, which is encouraging people to engage with the healthcare system and have cancer screenings.
Yeah.
I couldn't sleep at night if I wasn't, with my other hand, helping ensure that they're going to have a better experience this time than last time. So the whole country is moving in this direction and understanding that we have, that not all people are the same. And the "I treat all people the same" sounds like a nice liberal thing, but it does nobody really a favor.
Right.
And that the way to deliver what they like to call these days patient-centered care is to understand the differences among patients and clients and give everybody what they need. Not "I treat all people the same," but "I treat everybody the way they want to be treated."
Yeah. Wow.
So we have to help healthcare providers understand how this population would like to be treated. Meaning, if it's a transgender man who's not had top surgery, it's still called his chest, please. And if you would like that person to see a gynecologist, you should call it a genital exam. I mean, that's just a very simple example that will show respect.
Yeah. And I would imagine it just really changes the experience for individuals with their healthcare provider and greases the wheels for them to come back if they should need to.
Well, yes. But it takes more than that. We have to change people's knowledge level, right? Which is like, it's called a chest. That's knowledge. The difference between gender identity and sexual orientation, that's knowledge. But we also want to change attitudes. I want people to care about this community and how things that they've done with good intention or without thought are alienating LGBT people. And I want to teach people how to interact in a different kind of way. I mean, by the time, if you think about ever going to an emergency room, and most people have been there for themselves or with someone they love, think of all the people you interact with before you ever get to the potentially culturally competent doctor or nurse practitioner. First you saw the security guard, then the person who takes your insurance information, then the triage nurse, etc. You've looked at the form and you saw whether it gave you a chance to say who you really were or if there were, for example, only two options for sex that were male or female, and the only options under relationship were single, married, widow, divorced. There are so many messages that are given out all along the way. We need not just to change the individual practitioners, but change the system, change the policies, change the environment, the healthcare environment, to make it more welcoming.
Yeah. Oh, hugely important. Hugely important. The third prong here, advocating for LGBT survivors in mainstream cancer organizations, the media, and research. Can we start with mainstream cancer organizations? I think that maybe there might be an assumption out there that when we're talking about organizations, that this is their specialty, that they are all inclusive. But the more that I'm reading online, that's not maybe necessarily the case, is it?
It's not, but in that same heart in the right place, well-intentioned way, people say, oh no, this is meant for everybody.
Right.
So I, in my early years of this organization, if I had a free minute, and I had a few more then, I would go to things like American Lung Foundation or, you know, every cancer, Lung Cancer Association or something. Every cancer has a multiple websites. And I'd put gay, lesbian, LGBT in the search box. And usually they would say, nothing matches your search.
Right.
So I would send them a letter that said, especially if we're talking about lung cancer organizations, we have reason to believe that LGBT people are overrepresented among lung cancer survivors because their smoking rates are so much higher.
Right.
It would be great if you had something on your website for LGBT people. And they said, well, we mean it for everybody. And I'm like, everybody doesn't mean me.
Right.
If you only have pictures of white people, it doesn't look that welcoming to people who aren't white. If you only have information about heterosexuals. So you talk about sex after cancer treatment and you say husband or wife, I don't feel like you're talking about my people. You have to get, we start out wary and we're looking to see if you will welcome us. And it's your job, provider, National Cancer Organization, to let us know that we're welcome there. And I would offer to write pieces for these websites.
Yeah. Oh, it's such important work, Liz. I would imagine that just in similar to psychotherapy, that you get so much, maybe it started as a way to fill more of your time, but I would suspect at this point you're getting something much different out of doing this work.
Oh, yes. I mean, thank God that relationship fell apart. I found something else I loved.
Nice.
And it's changed my life. Now, I've never been diagnosed with cancer, but doing this work has changed my life. It's brought me into the national arena, and I've had the, you know, privilege of working with many national LGBT health activists, and there's a whole community of people because it does take all of us to make a difference. I love my work, both parts of it.
Oh, so great. Now, you wrote a piece called What in the World is LGBT Cultural Competence Anyway? And I'm going to link to it for folks over there in the Huffington Post. You know, look, I'm a professor who I teach about race. This is what I deal with all the time. This phrase, cultural competence, I think even more so recently in the past couple of years, has become such a buzzword that I don't even know what people are talking about anymore when it comes up. And you gave it such an amazing voice in questioning, all right, what are we talking about when LGBT cultural competence is put out there as a phrase? What prompted you to write that piece?
Well, I have a large grant from the New York State Department of Health to put together a 5-year grant to put together a cultural competence curriculum and train people to use it. And at first when they gave it to me, I was like, are you kidding? I could write it tonight. What do you mean 5 years?
Right.
And many people have cultural competence curriculum in their pocket, right? Undergraduates are training people at their colleges. But with this kind of time and funding, we were able to go back to the basics and really look at what are we trying to do here. Now, many of your listeners have probably also heard the term cultural humility, which addresses one of the many shortcomings of the cultural competence term,
right,
which suggests you can achieve it. And those of us in the community know you are behind in your language, you know, 6 months from now. It's a dynamic and ever-changing community.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when we first learned to say, what pronoun would you prefer? Then we weren't allowed to say prefer because it's more like, what pronoun do you use? It's not sexual preference, for example. It's sexual orientation.
Yeah.
So you can't ever achieve cultural competence. What I aim to do in my trainings is get people interested by showing that it's valuable to them, even if they're not members of this community, through a variety of ways, to do a better job treating this community.
Right.
And keep them hungry. I consider it success not if they walk out knowing the difference between gender identity or sexual orientation, not if they know how to say, do you have sex with men, women, or both, but when they're looking through whatever their local paper is or the New York Times the next day and they see an article about LGBT health, they feel like, oh, I want to read that. I'm interested now.
Yeah.
I want to get people to have an insatiable interest in this community, as they need to be in all communities that are different from theirs, but that are among the people that they're serving. The way to do that is to say it's relevant in your life. And, well, we do it in a variety of ways in our training. That's why we have like 5 videos, because some people respond more to the personal story, and we make little movies, and you see, you know, real LGBT people. And there are many ways that we do it, and we have people look at themselves and ways that they felt different in their lives and ways that they felt discriminated against. Because most people have had experiences of privilege.
Right.
And have had experiences of discrimination.
Yeah.
And the experience of discrimination could be because their family received public assistance, because they have someone in their family who is or was addicted to drugs. They could be new immigrants, whatever it is. Most people have had that experience. And we use that to build compassion for other people who are experiencing discrimination now, like LGBT people. And then we talk, going back to what you teach about, that we're not talking about a simple group, but a very complex group. Not every LGBT person is young, rich, white, able-bodied, lives in a big city. We are a very diverse group.
Yeah. What can all of our listeners do, Liz, to support this important work, to further your goals with this network?
Really, all I ask is that you take care of your body.
Yeah.
That is, in this day and age, still a political act. It is a radical act. Try to eat well. Move your body. Try to give up smoking. Use the quit line if you need to. There are LGBT quit lines even to help people. Eat healthy food. Try to limit your alcohol and drug use. And find a doctor. Use the power of our community, or one of the directories on my organization's website, to find a doctor who is safe and welcoming, and take care of your body. Because we need to live and continue fighting for our rights.
We need to. That's it. There it is right there. All of our listeners, you guys need to stroll on over to cancer-network.org. And right there on the homepage, the National LGBT Cancer Network, there are so many different resources out there. And I think it is about living. It's taking care of ourselves. And we certainly can't do so much of the work we talk about every single week on this show if we're not taking care of ourselves. So this is a great reminder that our health is paramount in order to do this work. Right, Liz?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you're helping my organization and you're helping me.
There it is.
I never sleep, obviously. I have plenty of energy. I'll do the rest. You just take care of yourself. And as I always say to people, if you love him, get him screened. If you love her, take her to get a mammogram. Take care of each other.
Nice. By the way, are you still working with the LGBT Mediation Project?
It kind of faded.
Did it fade? I have to tell you, I am such a fan of mediation work. I just stepped off. I think we talked about this on last week's show. I just stepped off as the board chair for the Cleveland Mediation Center, and I knew next to nothing about mediation even 2 years ago, and I'm such a convert now. I want to do so much more to get mediation out there because I think it would help in so many of the issues we talk about.
It's true, and I do it privately a lot. I help on a lot of people whose relationships, especially before marriage equality became the law, whose relationships took place outside of the law, to separate in a mutually respectful way outside the law. And I'm sure you know this, that when people make their own agreement, they're far more likely to adhere to it.
Indeed. Indeed. Liz, I'm so inspired by not just the work that you're doing, but your approach to it. And I think as we build more advocates for our own health, it's just going to further everything along in our community. And it will bolster really our entire sense of community. So critically important work. I know you're not doing it alone over there. So shout out to everybody who's working with you there at the LGBT Cancer Network. But really, really inspiring stuff, Liz.
Thank you. And I want all your listeners to know that they can send me an email and ask me anything you need, a resource, a referral, a question. I love email. As I said, I never sleep. liz@cancer-network.org.
As a wise guest once said on our show, Liz, you have to take care of yourself. So I want you to make sure that you're sleeping too.
I try.
Okay.
I try, but at least when I'm not, I'm productive.
Okay. Everybody, cancer-network.org. Liz, thank you so much for this incredible work.
Thanks for the opportunity to tell the world.
All the girls in the Paris night, all the girls in the pale moonlight, all the girls with a shopping bag, all the girls with a washing rag, all the girls on the telephone. careful with me. All the girls standing by your bed, all the girls standing on their heads, all the girls with a broken heart, all the girls with a deadly charm.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, not a ton of time left on this week's episode, but still a few minutes to spend on this week's latest LGBT news. We would not be a show that talked about the intersection between the news and LGBT issues if we did not mention the passing of Supreme Court Justice Scalia, but there's no way we could even begin to scratch the surface there, so I encourage you to check out all the latest commentary. There's quite an incredible piece over on theadvocate.com right now called Dear Straight People, A Note on Scalia. I encourage you to go check that out. We're going to go strolling over to some other news that you may have missed because we've been so consumed with the insanity of this whole Supreme Court justice nomination process and looking back at Scalia's legacy. Let's talk about South Dakota. A bill that would bar transgender students in South Dakota public schools from using the sex-segregated facilities matching their gender identity has gone to the governor for his signature. The state Senate passed the bill this week by a vote of 20 to 15. The South Dakota House of Representatives approved it last month. We covered that. If Governor Dennis Daugaard signs it into law, it would make South Dakota the first state to enact such a policy. The governor is a Republican and has said that the measure seems like a good idea and would listen to recorded testimony before making up his mind on whether to make the bill law. The legislation would apply to restrooms, locker rooms, and shower facilities. Trans students uncomfortable with the arrangement would have to seek permission from their school district to use separate facilities. LGBT rights groups have condemned the bill and pointed out that it conflicts with Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, which bans sex discrimination in public schools receiving federal funds. The U.S. Department of Education has ruled that sex discrimination includes discrimination based on gender identity. Chris Hayashi, the executive director of the Transgender Law Center, said this, quote, "Using state law to force a student to use a separate bathroom from their peers just because they are transgender is not only dangerous and wrong, it is a violation of federal law. If signed by the governor, this bill would endanger students and open up South Dakota schools to legal chaos, liability, and loss of millions in federal funds." This, apparently, is what they have time to focus on in South Dakota. So there's that bill. Over in West Virginia, this one is pretty nutty. An Uber driver should be able to deny service to LGBT people. That is something that a West Virginia lawmaker argued last week, and he won with that argument. Records show that 65 state House members voted against requiring an anti-discrimination policy for Uber that would have banned discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Just 27 members of the House voted for the amendment. Support for allowing discrimination was led by Delegate Tom Fast, a Republican representing Fayette, who argued sexual orientation is chosen. This is what's happening in the West Virginia legislature. We have a Republican named Tom Fast who is arguing that sexual orientation is chosen. He said this, quote, "I believe that it is a dangerous thing to elevate as a protected status a characteristic that is a chosen characteristic." You can watch his speech online. Being gay, it's apparently a characteristic that I guess we should remind you, according to Tom Fast, a Republican in West Virginia, is a chosen characteristic. The ride-sharing app depends on anyone being able to virtually hail a driver nearby and then catching a ride wherever they're going. The company has sometimes had trouble getting permission to operate in some areas, but the hurdles usually have nothing to do with discrimination. The bill has been sent to the state Senate without the anti-discrimination language for consideration. This is not the first time a state has wanted to permit Uber drivers to discriminate. The same thing happened in Oklahoma last year, and Uber reiterated that it has its own anti-discrimination policy that's inclusive of sexual orientation and gender identity. So in South Dakota, we're focused on bathrooms and schools. In West Virginia, we want to give Uber drivers the right to discriminate. And that's not the only thing happening in West Virginia. The West Virginia House of Delegates has advanced a bill that would allow any business or individual to cite religious beliefs as an excuse not to obey any state or local law. This is different than the Uber story. They're going even farther there in West Virginia. This is something that critics say would enable discrimination against LGBT people and other minority groups. The House of Delegates approved the measure last week by a vote of 72-26, sending it on to the state Senate. It has bipartisan support, with several Democrats joining Republicans in voting for it, while a few Republicans voted against it. LGBT rights groups denounced the legislation. It's called House Bill 4012. The Human Rights Campaign legal director Sarah Warbelow said in a post, quote, "Freedom of religion is a core American value, which is exactly why it is already protected by the First Amendment. Rather than protecting our freedom, HB 4012 would put LGBT people at risk for discrimination and go even further, allowing a person to use HB 4012 as a defense against child abuse or allow a pharmacist to argue he is not required to provide birth control." Andrew Schneider, the executive director of Fairness West Virginia, said this, quote, "Sponsors and supporters of the bill have admitted this measure is a direct retaliation against marriage equality and recent advancements in LGBT discrimination protection. It's clear that this legislation seeks to target the LGBT community in West Virginia and jeopardize the right of local governments to protect their citizens from discrimination." So there you go. Moving even further, not just about Uber drivers having the right to not pick up LGBT passengers, but we're trying to pass bills that would just discriminate across the board. That's West Virginia. I now have no plans to visit anytime soon. I should also add, I didn't have any plans to visit anyway, so there's that. And last but not least, Nike, the clothing, athletic company, shoes, all that fun stuff. Nike has terminated its endorsement contract with Manny Pacquiao on Wednesday after the Filipino boxer made derogatory remarks towards same-sex couples. "We find his comments abhorrent," the company said in a statement. "Nike strongly opposes discrimination of any kind and has a long history of supporting and standing up for rights of the LGBT community." This is what the boxer said, quote, "Have you seen any animal having male-to-male or female-to-female relations? If you have male-to-male or female-to-female relationships, then people are worse than animals." That is what the boxer said. He quickly apologized on Twitter. He said this in his apology, quote, "I'm sorry for hurting people by comparing homosexuals to animals. Please forgive me for those I hurt. God bless!" Exclamation point. So there you go. He was wearing a Nike logo when he filmed these statements. Nike said, "You will not be wearing that anymore. You certainly won't be getting paid for it." So Nike taking a stand. Kudos to Nike. Woo, that's a lot. And that, my friends, is all the time we have left on this week's episode. Two guests to thank. First, our thanks to Jake Graff, all the incredible work he is putting out there on the silver screen. And our thanks to Liz Margulies of the National LGBT Cancer Network. Please, please check out what she and all the folks she's working with are doing there. Please take care of your health, because you cannot make a difference in this world if you are not taking care of your health. Once you are taking care of your health, then you can get out there and use your voice to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters and all those allies out there. Whatever it is that you use your voice to do to make a difference, get out there and go do it. And while you're out there, while you're using your voice, while you're making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?